At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.
There's nothing more satisfying than finding the perfect green paint for your living room. Except maybe popping open that can of Valspar Ultra and rolling that first smooth stroke on the wall. And there's nothing more satisfying than admiring your freshly painted wall.
Ooh.
Except maybe peeling off the painter's tape to see those crisp edges. But the most satisfying part of all? Valspar Ultra's price tag, starting at $29.98 a gallon. Affordable, durable. Available at Lowe's. Price varies by sheen.
This is Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi. Here now, Tony Bruschi.
Sometimes the devil doesn't hide in the shadows. He walks right past you. On a trail, in broad daylight, a man in black, dressed like he's going to war in 100-degree heat, stares down families while gripping an oversized gear bag and moving like he's got a deadline. No words, just a look, just a mission, and then a couple is dead. Today, we're going deeper into the behavioral and psychological elements of this case, the Devil's Den double homicide, the silent signals, the predator mindset, and how to make sense of what doesn't make sense at all. Robin Drake is back with us, and if you're a regular listener, you know him. You know exactly what that means. Former FBI special agent, former chief of the counterintelligence behavioral analysis program for the FBI. This is someone who reads patterns for a living, who looks for structure inside chaos. And make no mistake, there is structure in this. We now know more about how the suspect moved. We know what he wore. We know we've seen the bag. We've heard from people who locked eyes with him. But the question keeps piling up. Was this man targeting Clinton and Kristen Brink specifically? Or did he go to Devil's Den that day just looking for someone to kill? That look, the stare people described, it isn't just creepy. It's functional. It's behavior of someone scanning for threat, for opportunity, someone choosing. Now that we're trying to figure out if he chose them in advance, or if the Brinks were just in the wrong place at the wrong time. We're also looking at the way he dressed, the choice of weapon, the speed of the attack, and the eerie quiet of it all. No screaming, no words, just execution. And that leaves us with two equally disturbing possibilities. This was either personal or practice. So with all that in play, I asked Robin to help us break it all down. How a killer this brazen operates under the radar. How small behavioral cues might give away motive. And why are you doing this? The only words reported from that scene, other than run as far and fast as you can, might be more revealing than we realize. Let's get into it.
First of all, Tony, I want to commend you for the work you've done on this case so far. Hands down, from all the cases we've covered in the last 3 years together, this is the best you've done. And I've actually tracking what's going on with the case, not with other outlets, but with you. And so with that, yeah, so we're getting a lot of data points, but no conclusions yet. And so when you let's break it down. So this stare that everyone's saying they're getting. What people are doing in these situations, in every situation in life, and it's playing out here, and it tells us a lot about that mindset, is we're assessing our environment for threats. And so my pure conjecture, obviously, because we don't know who this individual is, but as someone who's very obviously on a mission, very determined to do something nefarious and not good as he's assaulting this couple and ultimately killing them, as he's moving towards that target, he's literally assessing threats, the safety, his safety. And so he's assessing, is this a threat? Is this a threat? Is this a threat? So as he's mission focused, which makes him look incredibly incongruent with the environment because everyone else there is there for enjoyment, to be out in nature, to spend time with family. his objectives are completely incongruent with that. So he's going to look very different from that. And then as he's moving, he's going to constantly take in the environment for any threats to his safety before he executes the horrible crime he did.
That's an interesting take on it, because when I was initially looking at this and I heard that, you know, in real time with the hikers, what ran through my mind was he sizing them up? And in a way he was, certainly to assess if they were a threat to him, but was he also in the process of sizing up, could this be my target? Because the big question that a lot of people are raising here, you know, was this premeditated? What premeditated? Was this planned? I think the answer to that is a clear yes, but was it targeted? Or was he trying to pick his target as he went along the trail? That's why he had such the intense stare at the couple that we talked to and others who were out there on the trail that also witnessed this guy.
So it's a data point we don't know. Mm-hmm. So if I'm going to assess whether it was targeted towards that couple in particular or anyone else, like he like went out to purpose, in other words, to kill someone, mm-hmm. and he's going to find a target, or is he targeted to them in particular? We would need to take a look at the people that he did interact with and see what that dynamic looks like. The reason why I'm kind of moving away from that potentiality doesn't mean it's not truth, but the probability of it being lower is only because out of the couple that he targeted, he attacked the male first. Mm-hmm. And so if you're going for an easier target for a male to kill, if he's there to kill anyone in general, would not you kill the female first? Or another group that's out there, maybe there's two females that he encountered, which I think he did. You know, so in other words, if you're going for an easier target selection for the mere fact of, well, I want to kill someone today in this location, I would think that there'd be other targets that would look very similar or potentially even easier than a group of four. So that's why I'm just looking and everything I do, I always caveat it. I look at the laws of probability first so we can out rule things, mm-hmm. and move on to something else if that's not the case. So I always go down the laws of probability first.
And it was a group of four that he attacked, but two of them were small children. And the other group was four adults that we had talked to. So mm-hmm. that I could see very much. Yeah, maybe he knew he was not going to outmaneuver four adults. He wore all black, fingerless gloves. Again, remember, this is 100-degree day, about 104 with the heat index. It was hot out. All black, pants, shirt. We've seen the image now that has been put out by law enforcement of the man. This is what he looks like. It's a shot of the back. But he is, it's hot. That would be a lot to wear. That would be a lot to go. How does the physical presentation choices like this, inform what the heck he was doing? And as far as threat profiling, why was he out there wearing all of this? Obviously, it seems he was on this mission, but it certainly stands out. If you're trying to go incognito or not get caught, I don't think that was on his radar at all.
So again, I'm going to go with laws of probability here. It's hard to assess how smart or not smart he was in doing this. There's a lot of dumb things he did, mm-hmm. But as well as thoughtful things. So to be covered up like that, I mean, just think back to the Koberger case too, you know, completely covered up. And now we don't have any evidence of blood splatter anywhere. So if he's got an intent, he's got a knife, he knows he's going to have blood splatter. He's going to cover himself from head to toe so there's no DNA evidence on it. He's going to take it off himself, secrete it in that big ass bag he's got, and dump it someplace. So what I'd be doing right now, I'd be looking for that bag.
I wonder if he still has the bag. I mean, we still haven't found him. But yeah, mm-hmm. I mean, that could very well be a possibility if you did commit the crime and you're trying to get rid of whatever you're going to get rid of. That bag would hold a hell of a lot more than a knife, though.
Because it looks empty right there.
Yeah.
And so why would you have such a large bag? Why would you have any bag at all unless you mm-hmm. plan on using a bag for something? And so you look at the volume of clothing he has. Like you said, you look at the hot day. What would be the reason mm-hmm. to have a large bag? So I'm going to put something in the bag. What am I going to put in the bag? Probably the clothes that I'm worried about going to be blood splattered all over me.
Without a doubt. I mean, one of the big things that also was noted, because there has been some conflicting reports on what he was wearing as a top. Mm-hmm. And there was two times where eyewitnesses saw him before the murder and after. We have not conclusively narrowed this down yet. So the only assumption I can make on this, between the descriptions of what he was wearing initially, it's that black shirt. People have even identified that very shirt now. I've gotten screenshots of it because there's a little piece in the back of a graphic that you can see. Others right. have now identified what that shirt is and where you can buy it down to a T, which I thought was very impressive. But allegedly, some saw him in a tank top at some point. I'm right. going to guess maybe after the killings took place, he took that thing off. Maybe that's the reason for the heavy, heavy clothing was to get whatever he was going to get on that and then dispose of it.
I'm going on that because, yeah. again, all we do in situations where you have a lot of unknowns is you start just going down and ticking down the laws of probability so you can either rule that in or rule it out. So I'm going with the laws of probability of him using that as cover for blood splatter to secrete it in the bag and get rid of it as a possibility. So the first thing we now do is, all right, so let's look for the bag. And then we're going to be examining routes he was on. We're going to be looking at a lot of things. And then we start looking at, like you said, some saw him in a tank top, some didn't see him in a tank top. So now we have a potential for inconsistency of his presentation, which shows a little bit of chaos. Maybe he was determined and had some grit until faced with the weather itself. And so he's getting lazy. So I see from not just this, but also other some data points there. Here's someone who actually had a plan, but not a super well thought out plan, but good enough to do this and get away with it for a while. But what we also have is we have a ton of leakage of there's tons of witnesses that saw him, saw the vehicle. So that to me says not as thankfully not as well planned out as someone could have done this.
And that's what makes a lot of this case very intriguing and scary for locals is, was this man on a mission to go after this specific family, that specific man, that specific couple? And the way he did it, he didn't yell, he didn't speak, he didn't lash out, he just executed. Then right. he walked away. What sort of clues does that give us in terms of underlying motive? Number one, it's a knife, which is a very intimate thing to use, but a right. gun would certainly bring a lot of attention to a busy state park on a Saturday afternoon. So that might explain the choice of weaponry. But based on this behavior, is this someone, you know, is he operating under a fantasy, you know, delusional out there thinking that this is someone he needs to kill because they're a threat or whatever, a personal grievance, a power mission? Obviously, we're so early in this investigation and we don't even know who the man is as of this recording. But how does this read to you in terms of just the actions that he took?
Yeah, first of all, broken brain, hands down. You know, taking actions like he did, you know, we got someone who's got a really broken brain. So moving my non-scientific assessment aside of that, what we do in cases like this is, and what you and I do is, so let's look at the laws of probability and take the only few data points we have and do a deep dive on those to see if we can rule them out, because you don't want to say, oh, it's definitely this, because you can be wrong, mm-hmm. but you at least want to do a deep enough dive to rule it out. So in cases like this, and matter of fact, you and I were going back and forth on this as soon as it broke. And the first things that pop into my mind is things that you and I have seen before on cases like this. My first question is he divorced? Is there a child custody issue going on? Because typically if we see something that semblances like a hit, like it might be a hit, we've have reps in that there's a lot of times some child custody. And so we did a deeper dive, is it former marriages? And it looks clean on that slate.
It does, yeah.
And in, I don't remember the exact number. We're talking about 95 to 98% of the cases, the individual is known, maybe not by the individual receiving the violence, but known to the individual committing the violence. You know, Koberger is a great example. The girls might not have known Koberger, but Koberger definitely knew of at least Maddie, maybe. Mm-hmm. And so we now have to look at how could we, this individual possibly have some sort of connection with those two or at least one. And the only other data points you start getting in is recently moved from another location. So that's an interesting data point of a murder that happens after a recent move. And then the only thing I started looking at again, because the only thing we have is place of employment. And he stuck with the same company, it looks like, and he took a transfer to another location for a milk delivery company. Mm-hmm. So the only other data point you start exploring to try to flush out is workplace issues, people in his life issues, you know, and that's what law enforcement is going to do. He's got a very limited internet footprint. So is the wife. So I am doing my best to flush out and eliminate as a possibility, or maybe a confirmation, that it's somehow someone related to him in his life that's got some sort of grievance. And I say him for this reason. And it might be, like I said, unbeknownst to him, because all we other have now, too, is what was reported by the daughters of the things that the wife said, because he said nothing, is, and then you reported this, mm-hmm. why are you doing this, is what the wife said.
Yeah.
And so those words give me some clues that even if she was aware of who this individual was, she didn't know why he was taking the actions he was. So if that's the case, and he's going after the husbands first, there's some grievance potentially as a potential data point to flush out between that this individual had with the husband that the wife was unaware of. So there's some sort of potentiality of there that I want to flush out as much as I can. That's why I'm giving long explanations to, they just got to do a lot of interviews. They got to talk to a lot of people that were who knew these people, knew them at work, the move, what spurred the move. And then when you're doing these deeper dives on these interviews of people that are around them in their lives, here's what you're looking for. Who wasn't happy to see you when you showed up at work? Who was silent? You know, when you sat in a meeting, was there anyone that was in that meeting that just seemed off, that didn't seem to be completely pleased? I mean, so we're looking for a spike in the norm from a population that's in your life, a spike in the norm of an individual, one, two, and then that's where you not now need to start focusing against. So what you're doing along the process here is you're creating filters. All right, I can eliminate this group, I can eliminate this situation, I can eliminate this place of employment or not. So you're just creating filters as you go down, trying to see if this individual was connected in some way from the individual's perspective, not the victim's perspective, because he may or may not be aware of the wrong from the murderer's viewpoint. So you just want to do that. You want to flush out who in his life might have been potential, so mm-hmm. you can interview, figure it out.
Yeah, and that leaves us with so many questions, especially that, like you said, that why are you doing this? Why are you doing this? That's the one line we have. The last words reported from a woman watching her husband be murdered in front of her daughters. What Robin pointed out so clearly is what those six words imply. She didn't know who he was, yet somehow he knew who she, or more likely who he was, possibly. That's the tension in this case. The public's trying to figure out if this was random. The FBI, they're going to be asking if it felt random to the killer. It's a very different thing. Because you don't put on gloves, cover your license plate, and walk into a crowded trail in broad daylight with a knife and a sealed-off gear bag, unless you've got a plan. But the question is, how specific was that plan? Did he know them? Did he follow them? Or was he simply there for blood, and the Brinks happened to be the right level of vulnerable? Lots of witness reports in this case. The shirt, the tank top, the long-sleeve shirt, the bag, the chaos in presentation might not be an accident. It might be the unraveling of someone with a barely held together mission. A man who thought he had it figured out until the real world got hot, unpredictable, and left him scrambling. Maybe that's why we have no press conference, no timeline, and no confirmed leads, because law enforcement is chasing a profile built on fragments. But here's the part that sticks with me. And Robin said he didn't yell, he didn't speak, he just executed. That tells you everything about motive, or lack of one. This wasn't rage, this wasn't a crime of passion, this was clean, cold, silent, and possibly something he'd rehearsed. Or was this a rehearsal for more? So the work now isn't just in the forensics, it's in the interviews, the psychology, the community canvassing. Not for people who knew the Brinks, but for people who knew the man who hated them without even needing a reason. Because killers like this often leave just enough behind to follow if someone knows where to look. Let's hope someone does. And if they don't, we'll keep pushing, because those girls deserve answers. And this town deserves a lot more than a PDF in silence. Give me your thoughts in the comments section on YouTube. If you're not there yet, just search Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi to find us. If you're on the podcast platforms, do the same. Search us there on YouTube and Search us on the podcast platforms, Hidden Killers with Tony Brewski, so you can follow us on this case and all of the cases that we follow for you right here. Importantly, though, leave your comments in the comment section on YouTube. We do greatly appreciate that. Until next time, I'm Tony Brewski. We'll talk again real soon.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Brewski and the Hidden Killers podcast.